need no education. Welcome to Education Nation, where every Saturday morning at 10:30, we grab our second cup of coffee and tackle the biggest issues in American education. Your host is the headmaster of Liberty Classical Academy, Rebecca Hagstrom, along with co-host Pete Hegseth. School is now in session.
Well, welcome back to KLBB and Education Nation. It's Saturday morning at 10:30. My co-host, Pete Hegseth is here with me, and I am your host, Rebecca Hagstrom, headmaster of Liberty Classical Academy.
How are you doing? I'm just your humble co-host. And, you know, we always talk about a couple cups of coffee.
We do.
I put some Bailey's in my coffee this morning.
Oh, yeah, you did?
I did.
It's
going to be a spicy morning.
I was going to say, I might have to have a little taste of that.
It's going to be a spicy morning this morning. Sometimes you got to mix it up.
I was
going to
say, I actually need that second cup because I haven't gotten it yet.
There you go. Well, we're going to get you your second cup. I'm going to have my second cup of Bailey's, and this show is going to be amazing.
Wow. Okay.
It's going to be amazing.
Yeah.
We're so close to the election. I think it's just reflecting a lot of the feelings a lot of Americans have. We're so close.
Yes.
What do we do?
Did you hear that study that was out that said that the election was causing some of the most stress that Americans have felt before?
Really?
Yes.
I believe it.
Yes.
It was. I mean, how can it not?
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, it's all over the map right now.
Yeah.
But
it's one of the worst in my memories, I know.
Well, I mean, the contention is as high as it could be. Mm-hmm. The dissatisfaction with candidates is as high as it could be.
Yes.
The rancor, the anger, the angst, you know, we got. So I guess we're like. I guess, what is it, 3 days away from the election?
Very, very close.
I mean, this whole year, and here we are.
I know. It's coming down to it. And one of the things that I've noticed is that there's a lot fewer signs out there, and that's what I've heard kind of nationwide.
You're right. You know, I guess you see more Trump signs than Hillary signs.
Uh-huh.
The enthusiasm is real amongst grassroots for Trump. But overall, you're right. You probably do see less than in the past for presidential candidates.
Yeah.
I see a lot of local candidates.
Yes.
And I see some big, proud Trump supporters,
mm-hmm.
but you don't see a lot of big Hillary proud supporters mm-hmm. necessarily.
I don't think there's too many people proud of either candidate right now. I'm just going to say.
There is a bit of enthusiasm gap. You're right.
I would say, absolutely.
So we could talk politics the entire show if you want.
Yes, we could, but we're going to pivot. We're going to pivot because I know you would love to talk about politics the whole time,
okay.
Pete. Yes.
No, let's talk education.
But
that's
we are going to switch gears. Yes, we are. We are going to, but it's actually a little bit political because what we're going to be talking about today is the Department of Education, the Federal Department of Education. And one of the things that we have noticed over the years is that there has been a much larger hand from the federal government in the Department of Education than there used to be.
Yeah.
So we decided, let's take a look at the history of the Department of Education, because I really didn't know the history myself. And so we did a little research on this.
You did research.
I didn't. Yeah, you're the color, right?
So my job is to just show up. Your job is to do the research. So so we all make this assumption that the Department of Education has just been the Department of Education.
Right.
And it turns out that hasn't always been the case, and it isn't the history of our country. No, you really did some really interesting insight into this.
We did a little bit of research on that. And one of the things that we found out is that there was a department that used to be called the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare. And that eventually got split when Jimmy Carter was president back in 1979. He split off the Department of Education from the other two and then developed the Department of Health and Human Services. But where the Department of Education, which, you know, at the time was still connected to the health and welfare, really got involved with local education. It all really began in the 60s with the Johnson. He did the 1965.
Oh, LBJ.
Yep. Elementary and Secondary Education Act. And that was kind of the beginning piece. But we're going to talk more about some of those details. But I wanted to also point out that even though the local level has really kind of lost a lot of the ground that we used to have
mm-hmm.
with respect to education, the Department of Education actually still says that it's supposed to be controlled at the local level.
Wait, the actual
yes.
Department of Education says that
It's still supposed to be controlled at
the local
level.
Its control is local. Yes. Where does it say that?
Yeah. All right. So I'm going to read this to you. This is a quote from the DOE website, and it actually says, "Education is primarily a state and local responsibility in the United States. It is states and communities, as well as public and private organizations of all kinds, that establish schools and colleges, develop curricula, and determine requirements for enrollment and graduation." So it sounds good, doesn't it?
It does, yeah.
Yeah, but we are realizing that, or we all know, that it is actually not happening that way.
Yeah, I mean, bureaucrats can be very good at writing language that satisfies people, but the reality on the ground is what matters the most.
Yep.
And in this case, the department, you know, I don't know, not to get political again, but for years it was Republicans who ran about defunding and shutting down the Department of Education. Mm-hmm. You don't hear that as much anymore. I think it's because of political platitudes, and it's hard to say if you're saying shut down the Department of Education, you're being seen as anti-education, mm-hmm. which of course is not the case.
Right.
It's because if you're calling for the shutdown of the Department of Education, you're calling for that sentence right there.
Right.
That, like, I do believe it's a state
yes.
and local function.
Yes.
Because even a federal bureaucracy that has that quote is going to keep pursuing its own mandates mm-hmm. and keep pursuing its own control no matter what, because bureaucrats have jobs and they have lobbyists and they've got money and they've got responsibilities and they want to multiply. I mean, it's what bureaucracies do. So I take them at their word,
mm-hmm.
but the momentum of the entire department is in the other direction.
Right. Well, and that just is government in general, right?
Yeah.
It just seems like it, by nature, it just continues to grow and blossom, like you say.
It's like Jabba the Hutt in Star Wars. Can you watch Star Wars?
Oh, yes.
Yeah,
are you
that's
kidding?
Jabba the Hutt.
I think we had to watch those shows a lot.
He keeps growing.
I had four boys, remember?
Oh, yeah, me too.
Over and over and over
shaped
and over.
My life.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry.
Jabba the Hutt. That's quite the comparison, but you know what? That's really gross, and I guess
it's kind of
really bloated government is very gross as well.
Exactly.
So it's a good analogy.
Everybody
there.
Out there listening, put that visual in your head.
I
if you don't know Jabba the Hutt.
Our listeners.
Just Google it. All right? You young kids out there, Google Jabba the Hutt, and then you'll see government.
I think that might be the Bailey speaking.
It is. This is a Bailey's version.
We're a little bit loose. We're a little loose.
Fast and loose today.
With the microphone today.
We're having fun this morning.
All righty. Well, we are going to take a little break here.
Yes.
And when we come back, we're going to get into a little bit more detail about the evolution of the Department of Education since the 1960s.
No, exactly. I mean, I think what we fail at so often is not understanding history. And when you don't understand history, you're doomed to repeat it, or you
yep.
fall into this slump that it's just the way things have to be. And
yeah.
so I hope folks do stick around, because it is a very different perspective when you understand where we came from to where we are today.
Yep, absolutely.
So,
all right, we'll be back at the break.
Stick around. Welcome back to Education Nation. It's about 10:38 on your dial. The Bailey's is kicking in, so
yeah,
that's good.
I think it kicked in before with that Jabba the Hutt analogy.
It did, yes. It's in full effect. We are happy that you're here. We're glad to be in studio. We always love our Saturday morning opportunities to talk about these issues. I'm here with Rebecca Hagstrom, our host, headmaster of Liberty Classical Academy, and we're talking about the federalization of education, which we take for granted now because we kind of assume the way things are the way things have always been.
Right.
And that's not the case.
Right, right. Yeah, as I mentioned in the last section, we find that really this all originated with President Johnson, who was really adamant about his war on poverty. He was bringing federal aid into the poor and disadvantaged kids, which all sounds great. You know, there's always a good reason behind, or often, I shouldn't say always, there's often a good reason behind some of the legislation that ends up causing problems later. But the ESEA, the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, was passed in 1965, as I said earlier, with President Johnson. And one of his big issues was trying to help those disadvantaged kids. And so that was also when he started the Head Start program.
Okay.
I'm sure you've probably heard of that.
Definitely heard of it.
And I'm sure all of our listeners have too. And Head Start is one of those programs that really contributed to the federalization of education.
Unpack that a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Not all of our viewers will know
right.
Head Start. What
okay.
is Head Start?
So Head Start is a program that helps preschool-aged children who are from disadvantaged homes give them a Head Start on School, thus the title. And like I said, it sounds so good. You know, if kids are not getting the stimulation that they need at home, or if parents are just too busy, or maybe, you know, moms and dads are not available to these kids, it seems like such a great thing.
Sure.
But when you look at the research, interestingly, Pete, the research shows that it is not an effective program.
Hmm.
You see some early benefit from it, but by the time the kids reach kindergarten, all the benefits disappear as compared to their other peers. Well, I don't think anybody really knows. Hmm. And, of course, because of the fact that it does disappear, there's many people who would say, well, that's a waste of money. Why would you pour? I mean, I think it's up to $8 billion a year goes into Head Start now. And yet, and you know, political candidates, especially on the left, continue to promote it because it sounds so good.
It's so interesting because, you know, it's Ronald Reagan once said the closest thing to eternal life is a government program.
I never heard that line.
It's true.
It's a good one.
But something like Head Start is probably an example of that. I'm sure there are kids, and you would give this, you would acknowledge this, that benefit from Head Start, that benefit from that early focus, but you don't always get the metrics or the attention to the outcome of a program in the federal government that you do elsewhere. So once something started, it never ends.
Right.
And no one really evaluates whether it's effective or not.
Right.
That's a problem. So there's probably ways in which we could make Head Start more effective or give parents more options, or, you know what I mean?
Right.
But right now we're kind of stuck with this big federal program.
Right. Well, and, you know, without jumping too far ahead, it's hard not to right now. We know that Hillary Clinton is trying to offer, you know, universal child care or universal preschool.
Oh, so is Mark Gayton.
Yeah. And so I think that they would probably say, yeah, that's our answer to the fact that Head Start isn't fully effective. We're just going to try to get everybody in there then. We're going to just equalize them all. And
it's so true. It's exactly right. It's just like Obamacare right now. It's not working. Premiums are going up.
Right.
So everyone should just have single payer.
Right.
And then everything will be fine. Yeah. I mean, the answer is always not enough big government.
Right.
We need
more of
it. They
always go to more government, more money as the solution to every problem.
Interesting.
But interestingly,
Head Start,
are separate. Yeah. I was just going to say, there's the National Bureau of Economic Research even acknowledges that there is no discernible benefit from Head Start. And Brookings Institute, which tends to be a left-leaning organization, agrees that there is no measurable advantage for students in Head Start. Yet Obama proposed another $270 million to be spent on a program that's already spending $8 billion.
I just feel like, I don't know. There's a lot of blame to go around on disadvantaged kids and why they don't succeed. Mm-hmm. And I've always been a proponent of education being a pathway for them
to
succeed more. And
that's
why we're here
That's why we are here.
So you want to have programs that work.
Right.
But you also have to acknowledge that if they're not working, then let's change course.
That's precisely my point. And again, because this is a more federal level program, it's hard to change.
Sure.
Right,
sure.
And that's the problem with having the federal government involved in the educational establishment. So anyway, so that takes us then from the 60s. That's where Head Start was brought in. And what I guess my point is of spending so much time on Head Start is it's a federally funded program that is
still going on today, and
it's not really producing that great of a benefit.
Got it.
So then you get into the 80s when 1986, the NAEP, National Association of Educational Progress, they do some annual testing, and they found that we were so far behind in the reading. The reading scores were going down, math scores were going down. So once again, they're concerned because from the 60s on, our scores have been going down, down, down. So as much money as getting poured in, the scores are actually going down rather than up. And so that's when you start to see, once again, the government wanting to become more and more involved.
Sure.
And
I think we also, there were complaints then that America may be lagging behind. Mm-hmm. Then it was Japan.
Yep.
And before that it was the Soviet Union. Today it might be China. So there's this sense that if we're losing our edge, you know, federal leaders want to say, what do we do to regain our edge? Let's force these mandates down at different levels so that kids are learning certain skills that we think we need.
Right.
I don't know. I mean, I'll be honest with you. I'm a little sympathetic to that perspective mm-hmm. because you look at the national landscape and you say, okay, we're competing on a global scale.
Right.
We got to beat the Chinese. We got to beat the right. Soviets. We got to beat. So what's our plan?
Right.
But it, as you pointed out very well, I mean, the plan is actually, there's basic ingredients that are the plan as opposed to the latest shiny object that right. everyone wants to follow.
Right, right.
Right?
And once again, you can't expect a one-size-fits-all type of a program
sure.
to ever work. It just doesn't work that way. And anytime the federal government then tries to help out in that way, they're actually stifling the creativity and the local control, the creativity of the teachers themselves and the local control. And we're going to talk about that a little bit in the next segment because
yeah.
that kind of brings us up to today. So in the 80s, like I said, 1986, that was a watershed case where they found out that, boy, American students are really far behind.
Yep.
And so then there was even more effort at the national level to try to improve education. And that brings us then up into the 90s with President Bush.
Yep.
And he introduces the No Child Left Behind Act,
yep.
right? And
yep.
that was the first really big legislation since the Johnson, the Education and Secondary Educational Act of the 1960s.
Interesting. No, I think mm-hmm. this is great. I look forward to the next segment because you've got the 60s were such a beginning of government involvement on a lot of levels.
Yeah.
So it was like, the government will save you, says LBJ. And so he introduces these big programs.
Mm-hmm.
Then, you know, years later, we realize, well, maybe they're not working. We're a little worried about our competitive edge. We do a little bit more. Then George W. Bush, who runs as a compassionate conservative, says, all right, we're going to help the kids out even more.
Right.
And you sort of understand that.
Yeah, you do.
That impulse.
Yeah, because we want to help.
It's not a wrong impulse.
No. Mm-mm.
But I think it's easy to lunge at the federal government
yes.
to make it happen. So a lot of it, all of that impacts where we are today.
Right.
Which is what we're going to talk about next.
After the break.
All right, stick around with us. We will be right back.
Well, welcome back and join our conversation with us today as we are talking about the history of the Department of Education. And we've given you a little bit of background going back to President Johnson in the 1960s. And we're talking now about where things were when President George Bush took office.
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of blurred lines today about what's federal, what's state, what's local.
Right.
You hear about things like No Child Left Behind.
Right.
A Race to the Top, other things you're going to
yep.
dissect for us. But it really did kind of, in the modern sense, start with Bush and No Child Left
Behind. It really did. And at that time, of course, he was trying to, again, like you say, the idea is good. You want to improve education, but to look to the federal government to do that is not the right place to look. But even George Bush, who, you know, presumably is a small government Republican.
Well, on a lot of levels, but, you know,
yeah,
we missed the boat on a few.
Yeah. that was one thing he missed the boat on. And so he jumped onto that bandwagon and they did No Child Left Behind. And with No Child Left Behind, there was a huge emphasis on what was called profiles of learning and school to work.
Hmm.
And those were two big federally mandated programs that went down into all of the local districts all across the nation. And there were a lot of people that were opposed to that. Our own right here in Stillwater, Michelle Bachman, went head to head with many people over the whole profiles of learning and school to work back then. And that's actually how she got her start into politics. But that said, there were many who understood the damage that it was doing. And with those two mandated programs, then out of No Child Left Behind also came the requirement of standardized testing. And there was teeth with that testing.
How much federal standard federal testing was there before that? Was there a lot? None? Minimal?
No, it was more just a requirement of, you know, make sure you do something.
Okay.
And,
or SAT,
and
ACT to
yeah,
gauge your...
Exactly.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't know. So there was very little federal testing before No Child Left Behind.
It wasn't organized by the federal government.
Got it.
I think all the schools did it and the states required it, but it wasn't dictated by the federal government. And what they did with No Child Left Behind is they then said, if you don't meet this benchmark on this set of tests with your students at this school, then your school
will lose
will
federal funding.
Lose federal funding, and it may eventually shut down.
Interesting. Okay.
Yes, like
it
would eventually shut one down. They
good
old fashioned
coercion.
Put it on a report card basis, basically. Yeah, it was definitely coercion. And of course, in their mind, they're thinking, well, we're holding them accountable. We got to hold these teachers accountable.
Yep.
But what they're missing is that usually the teachers care. Now, understand that with teachers' unions, there can be a lot of bad teachers that are left in the classrooms, and that's a whole separate problem.
Sure.
But by and large, it's our teachers that are our greatest assets in the classrooms. I say at Liberty, and we all say at Liberty, that it is the teachers that make our program excellent.
Sure.
And so if you take away the power from the teachers and dictate to them what they must do all the time, then they lose their joy, for one thing. They lose their ability to be creative with the lessons that they're teaching. And suddenly it gets scripted, and then it becomes much less valuable. And the kids don't tend to do
a lot less in it.
Yes, yeah. So anyway, but with that, with the testing, it was problematic. We had schools and districts all across the nation that were really struggling under the weight of trying to meet these requirements, and especially with the achievement gaps, trying to get enough students to pass those tests, especially in those districts where they have a lot of minority students that were struggling on the tests. And so then when Obama took office, he then did the Race to the Top grants in 2009, which then allowed waivers from the No Child Left Behind requirements.
So, okay, so let me unpack it. I'm trying.
Okay.
I do listen every once in a while. No, so you've got dissatisfaction with No Child Left Behind.
Right.
Schools want an alternative. Mm-hmm. So the approach from Obama with Race to the Top is, if you follow our mandates, you get additional money,
right,
and you get to opt out of No Child Left Behind?
Right, you get a waiver.
Got it.
A waiver. And so therefore, the states, well, they raced to try to get that money, the Race to the Top. They loved it because they wanted the money, but they also wanted the waivers from No Child Left Behind because there was so much pressure.
Interesting.
And they were really struggling under that weight. And so that all might have been a good thing, except you're replacing one federally mandated program with another.
Tell me, what were we racing to the top of? No, I don't mean that sarcastically, but what is Race to the Top?
Well, the Race to the Top was, the idea was, we want to make our schools the top.
Sure.
So they named it Race
like
to the
that.
Top. But what they required is that the states accept, sight unseen, these Common Core state standards.
Got it.
Which had been designed not by the federal government directly, but with a wink and an eye and a nod from the Department of Education, who knew this was all happening, and that's why they then offered the money so that states would adopt them before they were even written.
So forgive me this, and honestly, listeners, I wish Rebecca and I had enough time to talk about these things sometimes before the show, but we don't. So I'm asking an honest question that I don't have an answer to. So you would say that Race to the Top was the gateway, was the opening for Common Core?
Absolutely.
Totally tied
Absolutely
together.
Absolutely tied together, yes. And they knew they were doing that. And they knew that the standards hadn't been written yet, but they knew exactly what they were doing. And then the standards, you know, they did race to complete these standards and then tried to say that they were internationally benchmarked when they weren't.
Sure. And go back, honestly, Rebecca knows this stuff back to front. Go back to our libertyclassicalacademy.org or KLBB's website. Listen to the podcast on Common Core.
Yes.
I mean, she's not just saying this as a platitude. She understands where this all came from. And so when you look at this history, it's important to understand that Race to the Top, as you're explaining right now, was the gateway for Common Core.
It absolutely was. And the states weren't actually being offered that much money. There wasn't that much money available to the states, but they raced for it anyway. And I think a lot of that was because they were trying to get relief from No Child Left Behind. So they wanted those waivers also. And I think they all hoped that maybe the Common Core standards would be better than anything that they had been dealing with prior,
sure,
with, you know, profiles of learning in school to work and all those.
We're always lunging for utopia.
Yes.
There's something out there. There's this magical purple unicorn that we're going to get, and everything's going to be great.
Well, and as we talked about last week, talking about local control and school boards, you know, there are still curriculum committees on the local school boards, but unfortunately, they've lost so much of their power because with all of the requirements and the restrictions coming from the federal government, they are not able to really choose and select the curriculum the way they might want to. Because if they have to have their students pass a test at a certain level, Well, then the test dictates the curriculum. That is just the way it is. And the people who wrote Common Core State Standards, you'll even find if you listen to some of their speeches, you'll catch them saying that. They know that the test drives the curriculum.
Of course they know.
And yet they will still say, oh, no, we're not coming up with a national curriculum. Well, yes, you are. You're doing it by default because you are creating the test.
You know, if we could get their emails, I'm not a WikiLeaks fan. I don't love all that. But like, I feel like it's another one of those examples where, you know, there's a public position and a private position.
Yes.
And we hear that all the time.
Yep.
It's like, I know behind the scenes you're manipulating this and creating this.
Mm-hmm.
But yet you come to me in front of me, you know, in public.
Yeah.
And you sell me something different. It's like Obamacare with Jonathan Gruber, who said,
yeah,
you know, the American people are stupid.
Yep.
I mean, they're every once in a while they admit it. But in this particular case, of course there's a desire for a national curriculum.
Yep.
And this belief that it can be dictated from the top.
Yep, they want it dictated from the top. So then that brings us up to today, basically. So last spring, we actually had the final rendition, or the most recent rendition then, of these federal education acts. And the most recent one is the ESEA, which...
Always
off
the
top
with
the of
acronyms.
My head, yes, I know. I'm trying to remember what that stands for. But you can go look it up if you're a listener. The ESEA is the latest rendition.
Is it ESSA?
Rendition. No, that's the original one in 1965.
Every Student Succeeds Act?
Yes.
Okay.
There we go.
ESSA.
Every Student Succeeds
Act. You're adding an E in there.
Oh, sorry.
ESSA. Every Student Succeeds
there
Act.
There you
yes.
go. Thank you.
Yeah, I tried to add something.
There you go. You did. So that is the one that was just passed last spring.
Okay.
Or last winter. And our local representative, John Klein, was very much involved in that and thought that he had done a great job of trying to put more control back into the local school boards.
Okay.
Problem?
What does Rebecca think, though?
The problem is that the requirements and the accountability at the federal level are still there.
Okay.
So as much as it might say that it's supposed to go back to the local districts, because of the accountability measures for both testing and teacher success and teacher evaluations, there still really is that federal tie, which is then still controlling the test, which is then still controlling
so
the
So you
curriculum.
Feel like it was a, maybe a good step, but in a kind of an unenforceable, teethless
yep.
first step.
Yep.
Okay.
I think he had good intentions.
I have no doubt John Klein had good intentions in
yep,
that. But.
Yep, I absolutely think he did. And unfortunately, and then, you know, the new Department of Education head, which is John King, he was a huge proponent of Common Core. He was out in New York. And so we're not going to get anything, we shouldn't expect anything different, I guess, from the Department of Education with him at the helm. Because
sure.
he very much is a supporter of Common Core,
and when we
so
were
he's going to push it.
When you were talking about this, you summed it up nicely. You said it's basically gone from students to standards, right?
Yes.
Over time?
Yep, that's exactly right. Yep. It used to be
it's a
about
great way to
students,
put it.
And unfortunately, it's about the standards. And the standards really lower the standard for everyone.
It's so hard because I'm all about standards. I love standards
and
accountability
and
all of that. But... when it becomes about the system and feeding the system, then the students get lost, right?
Well, and it needs to be the school district itself that is holding the students accountable.
Which is why we did the last two shows that we did.
Yep.
No,
yep,
I mean, Rebecca, thank you for having knowledge.
Yeah.
For filling my head full of it today and the rest of Education Nation. Seriously, no, this is fantastic. And, you know, it's why we do the show.
Yep, absolutely.
Day.
And
All
we
right.
look forward to seeing you next week. Join us on KLBB, 10:30 a.m.
See you soon.